This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Parrot Corporation. With a commitment to serving the St. Louis community through local partnerships and charitable support, guided by Parrot's core values. More at parrot.com/culture.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. Later in the show, we'll talk with Missouri Republican Senator Eric Schmidt about California immigration protests and why the so-called Big Beautiful Bill may face a big overhaul. But first, St. Louis tornado victims received some welcome news this week. President Donald Trump paved the way for federal aid to help people with housing, transportation, childcare, and medical needs. And the Missouri General Assembly approved significant tornado-related relief during its special session in Jefferson City. The special funds in particular include $100 million in direct aid to St. Louis and a tax credit that could assist people with recouping their insurance deductibles. It's much more generous than what Governor Mike Kehoe initially proposed for the special session. But in some respects, its passage may have played a significant role in making the now concluded session surprisingly successful. Joining us in studio to talk more about the state financial contribution to tornado relief is State Senator Stephen Roberts. Roberts represents Missouri's 5th Senatorial District, which takes in a portion of the city of St. Louis. Senator, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Glad to be back, Jason. Thank you for having me.
At the beginning of the special session, Kehoe proposed $25 million for housing-related assistance and a tax deduction to help recoup insurance premiums. What ended up passing was much more significant. How did that happen?
Yeah, so we made it very clear, and I've got to give credit to the other Democrats, Senator Leakin Huff, and the governor's team as well, that for the stadium bill to move forward, we needed real relief for the city of St. Louis after the disaster of this tornado. You know, that initial $25 million would have to be shared across the entire state of Missouri, specifically limited issues with temporary housing. So, you know, the caucus, I'd say, was sort of split as far as their opinion towards the stadium, but we were lockstep, and this is only going to get done if St. Louis is taken care of.
And what you're referring to, and we're going to be talking about more in the show, are incentives to keep the Kansas City Chiefs and the Kansas City Royals from bolting to Kansas. But let's break down specifically what the state is going to provide to tornado victims. The $100 million specifically to the city of St. Louis, especially with the news that FEMA will be providing aid to individuals, as well as state and local governments through public assistance, how do you think the state money can help tornado victims?
Absolutely. So when I worked with the mayor's office, and they've been phenomenal, Casey Milberg, Mayor Kara Spencer, have just been extremely active, not only here in the city, but in Jefferson City as well, as we made the case for the $100 million. And what was so important with how we phrased that was it is very broadly written. So it will be transferred to the Department of Public Safety, which Director Mark James is the director of. And he's been in weekly meetings with the city. So he's been very involved in understanding the challenges that we face. So, you know, to the other part of your question, you know, is that enough? No, but it's what we need right now.
And do you have any idea of what the mayor may use that money for? I think she talked a little bit about that in the House Budget Committee. It could deal with like short-term and longer-term needs.
Absolutely. You know, a big part still is folks with some of their houses that are still salvageable, you know, being able to pick up the debris that we still see all across the city, infrastructure, you know, sidewalks. I mean, you just have to drive around North St. Louis to Central West End to see how much help that we really need.
Now, with the caveat that the city of St. Louis has by far the most damage, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this tornado went through St. Louis County too. Was there any effort or discussion about including St. Louis County for this money?
So I'd say with this situation in particular, you know, and the damage to North St. Louis, most of those folks do not have insurance, and the challenges that they face, I think, are going to be much greater than some of our constituents who actually live in the county. So a lot of the discussion, just because of the devastation faced particularly by the city of St. Louis, is what it revolved around. And there is still that $25 million that the city and the county would be able to pull from.
Can you talk a little bit about that $25 million that will go to the Missouri Housing Development Program? And you mentioned this is not just for St. Louis and St. Louis County. It could be for other places with disasters, including Southeast Missouri, which was hit really hard on May 16th as well.
Correct. So, right, that funding is used basically for the whole state of Missouri. And that's why, you know, when you look at the Joplin tornado, for example, and Governor Nixon, who issued about $50 million, I believe, for their relief efforts. I mean, they have a population that is about 20% that of the city of St. Louis. It's extremely more dense. So a lot of folks, you know, from those rural parts of the state. And I got to give a shout out to Senator Lincoln Huff as well. He's
a Republican from Springfield who, as you were about to say before I interrupted you, is the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Yeah, chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And he was the handler for Senate Bill 1. And he actually volunteered when the Joplin tornado happened, went down with some firefighters to help cut up trees and remove debris. So it didn't take much convincing for him to understand the need that we had here in the city of St. Louis. And he was a staunch ally with the city, and really can't thank him enough for all of his hard work and advocacy for
us. And that MHDC program could help people find like temporary housing. Like if they can't be in their house because it's so damaged, they could go to an apartment or somewhere else.
Right. Temporary housing. Exactly.
Now, one of the big challenges here is that FEMA can provide about $43,000 in housing-related help to people. But you mentioned a lot of these folks, especially in North St. Louis, either don't have insurance or they have insurance policies that are not going to pay for the full cost to rebuild brick homes that are maybe going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to rebuild. Is what the state and the federal government, as well as the city, because they may allocate $30 million for the Rams, is that going to be enough given the enormity of the need?
No, we're looking at, from my conversations, well over $1 billion worth of damage. I mean, I don't think we have enough bricklayers in the state or even really the nation to kind of come in and do these types of systematic repairs that we're going to be needing all across the region. So, you know, I think we're going to have to start getting creative, working with our labor unions to find a path of rebuilding these homes in a way so folks aren't, you know, pushed out of their neighborhood, because as you know how expensive the brick and the history of some of these houses.
I also want to discuss a tax credit, which has not gotten as much attention, but I think is actually going to be very important. One of the things I brought up with Senators Tracy McCreary and Brian Williams is that the initial proposal from Keo of a tax deduction to recoup insurance deductibles, like that would have given people like $200, because it's not a tax credit, it's
right,
a deduction. So a tax credit up to $5,000 could be impactful, since homeowners insurance deductibles are usually in the thousands of dollars. How did you convince Republicans to change from a deduction to a tax credit, given that it's going to be more expensive for the state?
I think a lot of folks just could kind of relate to the unique circumstance of what happened with a tornado in a disaster like this, where folks were more willing to have empathy and compassion and try to find real help. And I think that's why you saw, you know, as we were kind of talking about earlier, the way the session ended with the use of the previous question and starting debates, and really me and my entire caucus focused on retaliation. You know, we all sort of stepped back in the situation because of this unique problem, and everyone kind of came together with the disaster relief.
And I will get to the retaliation part next, but I do want to ask, what sort of measures are going to be put in place specifically by the legislature or oversight to make sure this tax credit is not so needlessly complicated that people who want to recoup their deductibles just can't do it because they just don't know how, or it just is super hard to get.
Right. And I think that's part of our role as, you know, elected leaders, to kind of outline the process, the instructions that I believe the Department of Revenue will be putting forth for folks to apply for this. And this also goes for, you know, applying for FEMA relief as well. I mean, a lot of it is going to be educating our constituency on how to get these different types of relief.
Now, let's go back to the end of the regular session. You mentioned this, but just to kind of put a little bit more description on it, Senate Democrats were really, really angry that Republicans ended filibusters aimed at protecting voter-approved initiatives on abortion rights and earned sick leave.
Right.
And there was talk about Democrats making lives miserable for Republicans, but this did not happen during the special session. Can you tell me why you kind of held off on that aforementioned retribution?
Yeah, and the reason why Democrats were so upset, and it was the irony of it, is this is probably the most efficient, effective Senate I had seen moving until that part. I mean, we were actually at the beginning of session, we were moving legislation out of our chamber quicker than the House, which hardly ever happens. So, you know, a lot of the governor's main priorities, you know, state control, you know, he was able to get those done by finding compromise and working together with folks on both sides of the aisle. And with regards to the Amendment 3 and Proposition A, Democrats had offered a great deal that most of their members wanted to accept. It would have given them the Second Amendment Preservation Act for the strengthening gun rights and a deal for the stadium as well. And opposed to getting that done, they ended up using the previous question, ending all debate, and then the Senate adjourned shortly after that. So it is vitally important that the Senate not become the House. You know, if you're a representative, you can be limited in your debate. You are not able to filibuster. It's designed to function very differently. And that's what I have loved about the institution so much. And the use of a previous question is really considered an insult to the Senate as a whole, especially if you're dealing with a minority party that's willing to find a deal.
And you may have mentioned this before, but a previous question is the name for the maneuver that forcibly ends a filibuster. So,
right.
So just we know this as Missouri political obsessives, but people that don't pay attention may not. But I want to talk about kind of the political environment in St. Louis. It has been noticeable to me that a lot of the fights and the infighting among local officials have ceased during this tornado recovery. You've seen, for example, St. Louis Board of Aldermen President Megan Green working well with Mayor Kara Spencer, given that they are not like politically aligned. I mean, I saw you at a press conference with Governor Keough with State Representative Kimberly Ann Collins. You two ran against each other in 2018. But do you expect this kind of political detente to last, especially when local lawmakers have to deal with more broader tornado recovery efforts that may be more than what we've seen so far?
Right. Well, I mean, I would extend that good faith beyond, you know, just our, not even our local, but state, but our federal elected officials, you know, Senator Holly Schindler Schmidt, of course, Congressman Bell have all come to St. Louis and have all worked with the governor to push the FEMA and federal aid as quickly as they can. So, you know, long-term picture, you know, I think we all kind of end up reverting back to our typical criticisms. But I do believe that on this issue, from what I have seen, everyone has been united as far as getting St. Louis and the state of Missouri the relief that we need.
In the last minute, though, I do want to point out that I have heard and my colleagues have heard complaints specifically from North St. Louis residents about the inadequate emergency response, the sirens not going off, inability to connect with 911. Is there anything you think the state can do to provide funds or legislative guidance to make sure the emergency management system in the city is better going forward?
Right. And I think you saw a pretty swift reaction from the mayor's office as they dug deeper, removing the current disaster relief director, replacing them. So I think that there's, you know, we've, and to the mayor's credit as well, she's only been in the office for just over 30 days when this tragedy has hit. But I've heard from local elected officials, from our aldermen, all the way up to our governor, everyone has been very impressed with Mayor Spencer's response to the tornado.
State Senator Stephen Roberts represents Missouri's 5th Senatorial District, which takes in a part of the city of St. Louis. Senator, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
When we return, we'll continue our conversation about the special session of the Missouri General Assembly with Missouri House Speaker John Patterson and STLPR's Sarah Kellogg. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. The special session of the Missouri General Assembly's most controversial initiative by far was an effort aimed at keeping the Chiefs and the Royals from bolting to Kansas. And while that measure managed to get bipartisan support, it also faced vocal opposition, including from Republicans like Representative Bill Hardwick of Pulaski County.
And the reasons why we had these constitutional boundaries on how we make laws and what kind of laws we make is not for times when it's convenient or inconvenient, not for times when it's our favorite companies or companies that we don't like we're deciding on things, but just for situations like this, where we're about to pass a law that's patently unfair and unjust for the citizens of Missouri.
So how did Republican leaders navigate through bipartisan opposition to pass stadium legislation? Joining us now are two people who may be able to provide the answers. House Speaker John Patterson is a Republican who represents a part of Jackson County in the Missouri House. Speaker, welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. And also joining us from beautiful and scenic mid-Missouri is Sarah Kellogg, STLPR's State House and Politics reporter. Sarah, welcome.
Good to be here, Jason.
Speaker Patterson, why should Missourians give up potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in tax money so that Chiefs and the Royals don't move a few miles over the border into Kansas?
Well, I think the simple answer is that we'd probably give it up anyway if they left. But let me start by saying thanks for having me on, Jason. I think I was muted earlier. Let me start by saying
you're forgiven, Mr. Speaker, but continue.
Glad to be with you. There are people out there who would say that this is a giveaway, that if you look at studies, public financing, partly of stadiums, isn't an economic winner, that we shouldn't be doing this. And I can't argue with any of those arguments. I think, you know, there's a lot of validity to that. But I think the reason that ultimately I was able to support this legislation is that if you look at the deal that we have, if you look at the value of NFL and Major League franchises, I think even though we're going to take this revenue and divert it to building new facilities, I think overall it's a winner for the people of Missouri. And I think it's actually a big winner for the people of Missouri. And I don't begrudge anyone who voted one way or the other. I think people have to do what they think is best for their constituents and their state. But on balance, when you look at it, I think Missouri wins with this deal.
Why can't the owners of the Chiefs and the Royals, who I presume are mm-hmm. very wealthy, just pay for the stadium themselves?
Well, they are going to make a significant investment in both, and that's part of the deal that we have. This is a public and private partnership, so they will have to put up money themselves, and they're going to make significant investments in both of these facilities. Also, these are not going to be their stadiums. When they're built, they're going to be owned by the taxpayers. And it's not just the Kansas City Chiefs that are going to be playing in this facility. It's going to be Taylor Swift concerts. It's going to be Monster Truck. All of that benefits the taxpayers and the state with the tax revenue. So it's not just for the Chiefs and Royals, but they're public entities and the public will benefit from them.
Some of your colleagues contended that the stadium bill is unconstitutional, partly because it provides public funds to private businesses, and also because it just has too many subjects within the bill. What would you say to that?
I would say that, again, these are going to publicly owned facilities, so I don't have any heartburn that it's going to any private individuals. Again, they'll be owned by the public and leased to the teams. And then in terms of the things that were put on there, you know, we make a lot of laws during session. A lot of bills get put into place that are combined with other bills. I'm comfortable with what we did. I think you'll see it maybe challenging the courts, but I do believe that we were able to put this package together, and I'm comfortable passing it, even with the different provisions. It all had to do with taxation.
Yeah, one part that might be challenged in the courts, Representative Darren Chappell, a Republican of Rogersville, said another aspect of the bill, which seeks to lower property taxes in select counties, is unconstitutional because it's not uniform across the state. Here's what he had to say about that.
I think many of the individuals here in this room are concerned about the idea of being able to bring tax relief to their citizens back home. I believe that portion of this bill will be struck down by the Missouri State Supreme Court. because it does not pass the sniff test, even at the outset.
That was Representative Darren Chappell of Rogersville explaining his opposition to legislation that included property tax relief and incentives for Kansas City stadiums. What is your reaction to Representative's comments?
Well, that representative has voted on two laws that have been struck down by the courts, as have I. I'm comfortable with what we were able to pass, and if the courts take a look at it, we'll just see what they have to say and respect their decision.
Do you think that the legislature may have to come back in a special session to retool the property tax part of the bill? And if they do have to do that, doesn't that showcase a failure in the legislative process if they have to, like, redo one of the marquee things they passed in special session?
Well, I would like to, and I've actually urged the governor to do this, I'd like to see us do something in September when we're there anyway for our annual veto session to address property taxes. I'm not sure that we'll have to retool any of the things in this bill, but what I would like to see are places like Jackson County and St. Louis County included in some sort of property tax relief that many of the counties in the state got within this bill. I'd like to see us added to that, but I'm not sure this has to be retooled.
Are you concerned that the legislature spent so much money in this special session and in the regular session that lawmakers may have to produce, a leaner budget next year? Or could this even result in Governor Kehoe issuing more line item vetoes in this year's budget?
Well, I think fiscal responsibility has been one of the hallmarks of House Republicans, our philosophy toward governing. And, our budget that we put forward, and I know people were very disappointed about some of the things that didn't get passed in the budget, but we've been very mindful of that, and we've known for quite some time that the federal money that we've had the luxury of the past 4 or 5 years, that is all disappearing, and that budgets will be tighter. So you're absolutely right. We are going to have to watch our spending, but that was something we knew before this. If ever there was a reason to use the surplus funds that we have, I think it would be for disaster relief for our citizens. And that's why we want to keep money on the bottom line if we can, and which I think the House did. And I think it's an appropriate use of dollars that we did in this special session. But again, that's why we try to keep our budgets as lean as possible to have money for contingencies like this.
I would be remiss if I didn't talk about how some of your GOP colleagues signed a letter calling for the U.S. Senate to pass the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. And when I say the Senate, I mean the U.S. Senate, and that includes tax cuts, immigration restrictions,
yes,
and perhaps most controversially, potentially, major changes to Medicaid. I didn't see your name on this letter. Is your omission kind of expressing some concern about how this bill could ultimately affect Missouri's budget going forward, especially if the state has to pay more money for the Medicaid program?
Well, I unfortunately, if I signed every letter that I had the opportunity to sign, all I would do is sign letters. I don't think a mission is a message for anything. I think I'm very focused on what we're doing here in Missouri and really focused on our legislation and our budgets. One of the things that you did mention was cuts to Medicaid, whether it's altering the FRA program that we have or making cuts to Medicaid. That would be devastating to our budgets, and I'm not sure how we would even deal with that because the cuts would be so severe. So I agree with Senator Josh Hawley, who said that he does not favor cuts to the Medicaid program. We'll just have to see what happens with the federal government.
Tensions between Republicans and Democrats were very high at the end of session, primarily because of how the Senate passed measures taking aim at voter-approved abortion and paid sick leave initiatives. Do you think the special session alleviated those tensions at all, or do you think we're going to see more rancor next year?
I do. I think most of the kind of tension was in the Senate, and they have their traditions, and I totally respect that, and I think there was some bad feelings after the way it ended. I think in the House, generally, we're very collegial. I thought things went very well this session in terms of working with Democrats and Republicans. And then I think the session did help some of those relationships, given that we were all there in solidarity with our colleagues in St. Louis. And I think one of the best things that you saw in our session in the House was that Democrats really acknowledged and highlighted some of the efforts of their Republican colleagues to help during this the tornado, and that was probably the best thing that I saw. But and that always helps things when you're able to recognize each other for efforts that we produce across the aisle and recognize each other's humanity. And so, yeah, in the House, I think it helped. In the Senate, it helped a little bit, but I think the divisions are a little bit deeper there.
House Speaker John Patterson represents a portion of Jackson County in the Missouri House and will continue in that leadership role through the 2026 session. Mr. Speaker, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go to a couple of lightning roundish questions with Sarah. Were you surprised the special session wasn't a complete train wreck?
Honestly, yes, I was. I think that if this session had been just focused on the stadium bill, I think that would have had a lot harder time of maybe getting through the chambers. But I think pairing that with the disaster relief, I think that caused a lot of lawmakers to kind of look at the bigger picture and saying, well, if we can get this disaster relief through, then like a vote for the stadium bill wouldn't be unheard of. There are lots of Democrats that voted for that bill. I would not be surprised if that was related to the $100 million that eventually, you know, became, you know, got out the door. So I am surprised it wasn't a train wreck. I think combining those issues, I think, really helped get all of those bills across.
What do you think the success of the special session says about Governor Kehoe's ability to work with the legislature?
I think it says a lot. I know last Wednesday when the House or when the Senate was kind of going to debate the bills on the floor, they were supposed to go in at 10. They did not go in until 5, with pretty much the entire, you know, the story being that Kehoe was visiting lawmakers to try to get a deal, to try to figure out how people could hit yes on that, you know, button and vote yes on the stadium bill. And so I think that shows that he's willing to do the work to get these priorities done. It's negotiating with people that he knows might be a no initially. It involves negotiating with Democrats. I think it showed a lot of the work he's willing to do to get something that he wants.
Now, we all know that these political love fests don't last. In fact, I've seen a lot of Democrats very critical of Kehoe for preemptively calling out the National Guard for this weekend's protests over immigration enforcement, which we're going to talk about in the next segment. And we also heard from Senator Roberts about how Democrats are still upset about what happened at the end of the regular session, and they still may follow through on their promises to make life difficult for their GOP counterparts next year. We can't predict the future, but do you think next year will be rougher?
Yes, absolutely. I think, again, the subject of this special session being a part on storm relief, I think, again, there was a bigger picture involved for Democrats, and they knew that they couldn't really be maybe as petty as they want or show their opinions on how session ended. But next year, there's a lot of time that can be used. We saw a little bit of that, actually, a week or so prior to the special session starting, where Democrats, it was a session where they had to sign the bills and there wasn't a quorum, and Democrats called for a quorum and they had to adjourn and go the next day, where all these Republicans had to drive to Jefferson City. I think we're going to see things like that. I think it's definitely going to be there's going to be a lot of tension next year.
My last question for you. So much got done during this session that I'm struggling to figure out what are going to be the major issues in 2026. Again, we can't predict the future, but were the Republicans too successful and they may just have nothing to do next year except maybe like create official state birds or official state dinosaurs or whatever?
I think there's always going to be legislation to pass. One that I know Senator Roberts mentioned was maybe repassing the Second Amendment Preservation Act, SAPA. That didn't get through both chambers. It only got through the House, but I think we're going to still expect to see a debate on video lottery terminals. So gambling, the machines that you see, the gaming machines in like gas stations. So I think we're going to see legislation on that. There's always going to be issues that pop up. Those are maybe two at the top of my mind, but I think they'll be plenty busy.
And I also think that, as I mentioned to the speaker, whatever passes out of that big, beautiful bill, which is still really in flux right now, it could have a huge impact on the Medicaid program and on the budget. So that's something that we're all going to have to be looking at very carefully going forward. But, you know, Sarah, I think it's time for a little bit of a break from the legislature, and we appreciate how much you keep out a lookout for the state as our State House and politics reporter. Sarah, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Jason.
When we return, we'll talk with Senator Eric Schmidt about protests over immigration enforcement and the future of that aforementioned so-called Big Beautiful Bill. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. While the General Assembly special session and the governmental response to the May 16 tornado have been top of mind for a lot of Missouri policymakers, it's impossible to close this week's show without talking about other national events that are grabbing people's attention. That includes President Trump's decision to send members of the military to California in response to protests over immigration enforcement. It's a move that has sparked furious debate, especially since it was done over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Earlier this week, I spoke with Missouri Senator Eric Schmidt about Trump's handling of the protests and whether his posture toward immigration enforcement is missing the mark. But to start off this conversation, I asked the Republican senator about Trump's decision to approve federal aid to help St. Louis area tornado victims. Here's my conversation with Senator Eric Schmidt. Now, before I ask this question, I do think it's important to note for context that in past administrations, the average time between when a disaster happens and a president signing a disaster declaration is usually around 6 to 8 weeks. So a 3-week window is not especially unusual. But I do have to ask, especially since Kentucky got a major disaster declaration for the same series of storms in 6 days, did this process take too long, in your view, for this federal aid to come to St. Louis?
I mean, I think the context that you gave about typical timing is important here. I'm glad it happened. We were able to get that declaration for the storms that happened earlier in the year that also included St. Louis County mostly, I think almost exclusively St. Louis County and other parts of the state. But I'm glad it happened, and it was a very bipartisan effort. Was in constant contact with the mayor about it, Governor Kehoe. I talked to President Trump himself about it. Talked to Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, about it specifically, other people in the administration, to make clear that it was a priority for us. We had seen the devastation. I had been there on the ground the next morning, had been back with the mayor to tour some of what they were doing as far as their internal operations on the response, and also went around. And I'm back every weekend, so I'm in St. Louis and saw the damage myself. So I think that they handled it. They did a thorough review. No timetable, I think, when you're dealing with something like this is fast enough, but I'm glad it got done. And I think it's a testament of when we work together, these kinds of things can be accomplished in really difficult circumstances.
This disaster declaration occurred in the same week that President Trump told reporters that he wants to phase out FEMA after the 2025 hurricane season. And look, I'm willing to entertain the conversation that there should be a more direct funding stream to state and local governments to handle disasters, because FEMA has historically been very slow to react to things like this. But my question for you is, if this phase out doesn't come with a significant amount of money going to states, I think we've seen with the St. Louis situation that they're not going to be able to handle major disasters without federal money. So where does kind of the balance go from giving state and local governments more autonomy to do disaster response, but also making sure that the federal government provides money to actually execute things?
Yeah, look, I think FEMA is ripe for reform, and I think that's a good starting place. And I think you could get broad agreement on that fact. It often doesn't move quickly enough. It's been riddled by even some scandals at the end of the Biden administration, where people were making determinations based on what kind of yard signs were in people's yard, that there's no place for that kind of politics as it relates to disaster assistance. We're all Americans. If it happens in California, or if it happens in Missouri, or if it happens in Georgia, there's a reason why you have federal disaster relief. Getting to the more reform-minded view of this, I do think, as you saw in St. Louis, I think it's best to just sort of think of that example. You had the locals on the ground. You had the state on the ground. We were able to unlock tens of millions of dollars earlier in the year for state disaster assistance grant funding. So we worked with Secretary Noem. I was on a phone call with her and Governor Kehoe. You know, what's the status of this grant funding? That was unlocked. That allowed them, for example, the a lot of those emergency disaster relief agencies that the state controls to be on the ground in St. Louis that day. So we were very happy that we were able to do that. But the punchline is, I think the locals are better suited to make these determinations. And so what FEMA effectively is kind of a conduit of federal funds. So if there's a better way to do it, for the federal government, of course, to have a role in that, to empower the locals in a more timely way, I would support that. So, but until you see the contours of what that exactly is, you know, you'd want to pump the brakes a little bit. But I do think we can do better than what we have now. I mean, in Republican or Democrat administrations, we've seen the failures of FEMA. And some of that's because of the bureaucratic maze that exists. So part of, you know, my effort on this and others to unlock the St. Louis disaster relief funding was to try to cut through that red tape, to not get, you know, sort of bottled up with a mid-level bureaucrat. And I think because of some of the relationships that I have, we were able to be effective there. Again, not exclusive to me, but I think everybody pulling in that direction is helpful.
I want to turn to what is going on in Los Angeles right now. And before we talk about whether President Trump has the authority to send the National Guard over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom, which is going to be decided in court, I want to actually talk about the crux of what the protests are. And that is that ICE officials have stepped up high-profile raids against people suspected of being in the country without legal status. I mean, there has been a backlash to this type of immigration enforcement, even in Missouri, which you saw in Kennett, where somebody who is originally from Hong Kong was detained by ICE, which caused like a very big backlash in that conservative community. So my question for you is this really an efficient way of immigration enforcement, going after people that may have technical violations of their immigration status, instead of hyper-focusing on people that may be in the country illegally and may have fundamentally and clearly committed crimes where they need to be deported?
Well, let's be clear. The situation in L.A. started with ICE agents trying to break up a criminal enterprise. These were illegal aliens that were connected to the cartels, and that was sort of the epicenter of the L.A. unrest and the riots that have happened since then. Do I believe that we should enforce federal law to deport illegal immigrants on a mass scale? I do. And President Trump ran on this. This is not a surprise. This was put squarely in front of the American voters last November. There were two big issues. There was immigration and there was inflation, right? And so President Trump was very clear. We are going to, the 15 million people here illegally, we're going to start with the worst of the worst, but we're actually going to enforce federal law. And if you don't enforce it, the law really doesn't mean much. I think what you're seeing happening right now on the left is they didn't think they were going to lose. They didn't think Trump was ever going to come back. And this effort through NGOs and other organizations to get people here, they're very upset that people might have to go. And it's incredibly dangerous. When I was Attorney General in Missouri, we were engaged in some litigation. I went to the border myself. The amount of human trafficking that takes place, with women and children being sexually abused and trafficked to the tune of $100 million a week, that's the economic value of that. So there's no compassion, in my view, or the compassionate take isn't we shouldn't be deporting illegal immigrants. The cartels need to be delivered a message that their efforts, which they gain economically from, aren't going to work anymore. And now you see, our Senate conference just spoke with Tom Homan yesterday. These are record low numbers, like 12 gotaways as opposed to thousands and thousands under the Biden administration. They just weren't interested in enforcing the law. And now President Trump is. So you can have a debate about where and when, but nobody has a right to be here illegally forever. They just don't. And if you believe that, you don't really believe in a sovereign country. So I think that it's sort of a moment now where we're going to have this big debate. And I can't believe, actually, that my Democrat colleagues, are going to make this their hill to die on again. But here we are. You've got one of my colleagues that was, you know, down in El Salvador with an MS-13 gang. Remember, he's now back, and he's going to be tried for trafficking human beings again.
Has it been clearly defined whether that person is an MS-13? I think there is a lot of dispute over whether that's actually true or not.
Well, according to an immigration judge, he was. And now he's going to stand trial in the United States again. So we're going to actually get a clearer picture of who this guy was. But again, I just think it's, you don't need to swing at every pitch in politics. And I feel like the Democrats on this immigration issue, they're going to be on the wrong side of it again. The American people, even recent polling this past weekend, support President Trump's response. They support deporting people who are here legally. And of course, the worst of the worst. So I think that you're going to see probably more of this as the left grapples with the idea that you have a president who wants to deport illegal criminals.
But let's get into a broader conversation about the maximalist enforcement of federal law. You don't see DEA agents going into dispensaries in Missouri raiding marijuana sellers, even though that's federally illegal. You passed a law saying that TikTok had to be sold from a Chinese entity, and TikTok still exists. I understand what you're saying about people wanting maximalist immigration enforcement, but if you're not doing that for other areas, isn't that not a consistent application of actually enforcing federal laws?
Well, I would draw a distinction on two fronts. First is, this issue was front and center. You didn't have the President of the United States running on the two issues that you mentioned. You had the President of the United States saying, there are 15 million people that came here in a four-year period of time through an effort of mass migration, and he's going to confront that mass migration with mass deportation. So the issue was squarely in front of people. He ran on it. I think that's, you know, an important thing to point out. And also, the level that we've never seen anything like this, Jason. I think you're going to have a response. And I think that, again, the Democrats were engaged in this effort, and it was electoral politics at the heart of it. They thought that actually would affect redistricting. You don't have to be a citizen to be counted in the census. So this was a much larger play, and they lost. And elections have consequences, as many people have said. And one of the consequences here is we have a president that's going to enforce immigration laws. And that's just going to be the reality. That's not going to change. So all the kicking and screaming and the firebombing and the Molotov cocktails isn't going to change that reality.
Well, let's go to the specific dispute I talked about earlier. I'm not going to make an argument that there hasn't been violence in these protests, because they have. I have eyes. I saw that autonomous car on fire. I think the question, though, is whether this constitutes rebellion or insurrection. I mean, I know we could play the whataboutism game for every question I'm going to do, and maybe I am. But I think if President Obama had commandeered the National Guard during the riots in Ferguson and, like, ordered the National Guard to start shooting people, you would have probably called for President Obama's impeachment as a state senator. So I think this is a real important question.
I've known you for a long time, Jason, yeah. But I don't know that. I just thought it was a presumptuous take to know how I would respond to the unrest in Ferguson, whether or not.
But can you get? Could you address the point about who has the right here to call out the National Guard?
The president has the absolute right. If federal agents like ICE agents are being attacked, they're throwing bricks off of overpasses at federal agents. Federal buildings are at risk and being firebombed. When that happens, the President of the United States has the ability to protect those assets and people. And that's what's at stake here. I think what is telling, though, you know, you have some Democrats now acknowledging the violence, even though they were in denial at first. But what you don't hear any Democrats saying, which is sort of the tell here, which is, you know what, everybody needs to take a step back here and let these ICE agents do their job. And the reason why you won't hear that is because they want to dismantle and defund ICE, and they don't actually believe in enforcing immigration policy in this country. The laws that have been passed by the Congress and signed by the president, including, by the way, Bill Clinton, and including, by the way, Barack Obama. So really, the last 4 years, Jason, I would say, is a real departure, even for Democrats, to somehow not even accept the fact that we would be deporting people who are here illegally. Barack Obama deported millions of people, millions of people. Bill Clinton deported, I think, 12 million people. So this is not a new concept. I just think kind of politically where we're at, somehow this has become more controversial. And maybe it's because President Trump's in office. That could be part of the explanation. But again, I think most people support a president enforcing the law.
In the last couple of minutes we have, I do want to shift to the big, beautiful bill, which is, I think it's a great name for, regardless of what you think of the substance, I think that is a good name for this. It rolls off the tongue. We're probably going to be talking about this a lot more, and we probably need to spend more than 2 or 3 minutes on it. But I do want to focus in on the Medicaid aspect of it. I think there will probably be some sort of work requirements. I think that has been agreed with by pretty much every Republican in Congress. I think the disagreement, though, comes from, like, things that are going to make Medicaid more expensive for the states. I think one thing that I've been paying pretty close attention to is restrictions on the ability of states like Missouri to tax healthcare entities like hospitals. I'm pretty sure that when you were a state senator, you dealt with FRA reauthorization on a semi-regular basis. How are you going to make changes to Medicaid in particular without sending Missouri's budget into a cataclysmic tailspin?
Well, I do think, I mean, having seen it myself, I do think there are some reforms. I mean, I think the FRA, it sort of juices up payments and then you get reimbursed for it. And the federal share goes up beyond the typical, say, 60-40 share. Like that, objectively, that's true, right? That objectively. I remember in Jeff City, a lot of people call it free money. I mean, that's not, you know, that's probably not a good way to look at it. So maybe there are some reforms that can be had there. But I would say this. The discussion, and I've been pretty clear on this, benefits aren't going to be affected unless you're one of the 1.4 million illegal immigrants in this country that are on Medicaid. I think that that will be a provision that holds, that you will not be able to access taxpayer benefits if you're here illegally. And I also think, you know, making sure that the people who are eligible are receiving the benefits. I think the program has a lot of importance, especially for those who need it most, individuals with disabilities. I'm actually working on a provision to help strengthen this for people who are most vulnerable. And I think that's something that we can kind of all come together on. So I think that there's been a lot made of sort of Medicaid cuts. That's just not going to happen. It's just not true. But I do think the system, there can be reform with waste, fraud, and abuse. I know that's a term that's used, but there's a lot of it. And if there's anything that came from sort of the DOGE efforts, is that it exposed a lot of this. You have new technologies and new tools to uncover a lot of that waste, fraud, and abuse. And for me, it's about strengthening the system then that serves our most vulnerable. And I have a clear track record on that. That's who I am. That's who I'm always going to be. And that carried forward in this debate as well.
You mentioned DOGE. How damaging do you think Elon Musk coming out against this bill has been for it to be passed in the form that it came out of the House? It was going to change in some ways, but, like, love him or hate him, Elon Musk has a lot of fans, especially among the younger male base that voted for Trump. Did he basically kill this effort by saying that this is going to explode spending beyond a level that is reasonable for people like him?
Look, I think I've gotten to know Elon Musk through this process. I think he's very sincere in his efforts to find real savings, structural savings. And I think DOGE went a long way in doing that. There's still more to do. I think he cares about the skyrocketing national debt. And those are concerns that I share, too. And I think that we're going to have a chance as that House bill, the big, beautiful bill, has made its way over to the Senate now. We want to make it more beautiful. I was in the Oval Office just yesterday talking to President Trump about this with some other senators about how we can do that on the Senate side. But I'm confident, I want to be clear, President Trump is the leader of this party. I mean, he ran on these issues. He's expanded the base. I feel very much at home with this party now, having grown up in North St. Louis County in a working class neighborhood. So I think what President Trump has done is historic with the comeback, and he had an agenda. And I think whether it's no tax on tips or no tax on overtime, or, you know, all the sort of things that making sure we don't have a $4 trillion tax increase by not extending these tax cuts for middle class families, that's all really important for us to do. I'm confident that we're going to come together and do it. The margins aren't huge, but we're working in the Senate. We're having meetings every day about how do we put our package together, how do we work with the House, how do we work with the White House to end up with a big, beautiful bill sometime in July.
That was Missouri Republican Senator Eric Schmidt talking with me earlier this week from his office in Washington, D.C.
The Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air is produced by Jason Rosenbaum Alex Hoyer, Emily Woodbury, Danny Wisentowski, Maya Norfleet, and Elaine Cha.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.